Well, it's here.
Welcome back, everybody. The Movie Review Corner is making another triumphant return. This time, because either we really hate both of these or we really love both of these. So we're only keeping it to two movies instead of three.
Yep.
Or I guess maybe we did that last time, too. Whatever.
I don't know what we do on this podcast, but
we don't listen to our show, so you guys let us know what we said last time.
When we are done talking, that thing is sent to Will, and it goes up. That's our final time. We got two big ones, and if you're a long-time listener, then you're not going to be shocked that we are going to talk about these two movies. This fits right into what we've talked about for years now. But if you
are not going to be The Substance or Anora right now, we'll probably talk about definitely one of those, but probably both of them at some point, or maybe just one of them because one of them just makes us sad and we don't want to talk about it anymore.
We can just avoid both because everyone else is talking about them. So.
That's true. I still haven't seen Anora also. So,
well, I'll give you my review. It's fine. It's good. I mean, I liked it. I didn't dislike it, but I think people don't see enough movies in this world. And they get when one thing that's just better than so much of the crap that comes out, they just best movie of the year. Oh, my God.
I mean, it's hard for him. I don't know if you agree, but to me, Red Rocket is probably number two in his entire filmography. So it's hard to top that one coming off. But as I said, I haven't seen, so we'll see.
Well, and as we've said on stage at many of our shows, it's dedicated to Mr. Jess Franco. So
and Lena, or sorry, and not Soledad. Lena, Soledad. Thank you.
Come on, get your Spanish women straight. They're not all the same, Will.
They might be.
Actually, maybe, yeah. Yeah, so there you go. So now we don't have to do that. But I'm going to take a guess. I bet you all can take a guess what we think of The Substance. So,
yep. You know, we'll just say it's a movie that lends itself to too many easy jokes. All the jokes are boring. None of them are more boring than the movie is.
Yeah. And if you love that movie, you might be pretty boring. So. But hey, it's all love here. There's no hate this year. This is I'm meditating more. So
that's right. Say okay. I did acid, so I'll feel good for at least a week and a half. So we're feeling.
Yeah, we'll be good until 2025 hits. All right.
Okay, back to the normal. But in the meantime, we're gonna talk about two movies. That we haven't even talked about them yet, but we know each other pretty well at this point. That we both loved a lot. So first up, what are we gonna get into?
Mr. Robert Zemeckis's latest opus here. Now, I think this is the more bastard child of this duo. I don't think it's getting as much love, but I will say the only reason Juror Number Two is getting so much love, not only just because it's great, but you know, it's in 2024 it became hip to be like, you know what, Clint, daddy,
that's right, y'all finally fucking listened.
Yeah, about time. After you were all like bitching about The Mule, saying how I don't know, because Richard Jewell hates Hillary and his pro or whatever was going on at that time, it wasn't cool. I guess it's become cool now. So, hey.
Welcome to the high life, guys. It's a good place to be. And yeah, we'll talk about more of the rollout and all that shit when we get to that one. But
yeah.
Bobby Z is back.
Well, I'm only pointing that out because these are two different beasts, though we're fighting a very similar battle. So as much as we tried to hip everyone to say it's cool to like Robert Zemeckis, we can only do so much with the cultural.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a few more years.
Yeah.
I think he's going to have to die, honestly, before people will take us serious about him. I really do.
You're probably right, honestly. But, I mean, this is just, it's sad because the movie's bombing, but it's also like, how long have we waited for this, you know, Zemeckis to come back? Like, we had to sit through The Witches, we had to sit through Pinocchio, and even though we found Pinocchio to be a bizarre failure that was quite fascinating. Yep. You know, it's like, this was not the Zemeckis we were looking for, but here he is, corny and as technologically savant as ever.
And I would also say possibly more acidic than ever, which we'll get into.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a...
I think he's furious and also has a more tender heart than he's ever had at the same time. I think both sides of that parts of him are running full steam.
Yeah, I can definitely see a man who's wondered when the world will keep up and give him the accolades he deserves, and how he watches time just tick, tick, tick by. I mean, the movie does deal with a lot of male figures that are having lots of career woes and not getting to be what they want to be.
Yes. And just to, I guess, to get it out of the way so we don't have to return to it as we just share our thoughts. In case you've missed the whole, when we did a whole retrospective, literally at the theater or on here, everything he's doing is intentional. He knows how it looks. He knows what the dialogue sounds like. He knows exactly what the music sounds like. It's all on purpose. It's not some inept thing. He knows exactly what he's doing, and it's all on purpose, and it all has a purpose. And including what everyone loves to call Uncanny Valley, which I can rant on right now, or we can wait till we get further in.
Why don't you do that? Because there's a lot of people who love to, you know, the one article they've read about AI, apply that logic to everything about the anxieties around AI. Because
yeah. Well, I guess
not that. This movie is not doing the things that we all, you know, got on the picket line and said, or we didn't, but people did, and said, hey, we stop this, until October 7th happened, and then no one gave a shit about what was going on with that anymore. Yeah. But this is not that.
Yeah. And before I specifically rant about that stuff, as it applies to this, I just want to remind everyone, including us here as well, we also watched it and enjoyed it, whatever, but no one's trying to rail against Harmony Korine for using AI in his experiments as of late, because they're having fun, because they like to smoke weed, right? And that's cool. I'm not saying anyone should be railing either, but Harmony is very much using consumer AI shit that all of us can use as well and just slapping it on. That's not what's happening here. So let me just remind everybody, when you want to get on your moral high horse, you don't get to have exceptions. So if you're going to do that, then you got to be mad at everybody. Otherwise, yeah, just fucking watch the movies and then talk about what's actually happening. As far as Zemeckis, I also want to remind everyone that this is not new, right? Like, he's been doing quote unquote Uncanny Valley for a long fucking time, all the way back to Forrest Gump for sure, arguably even before. Death Becomes Her also has stuff in there as well. So he's been exploring this stuff, this unreality type of idea of effects, for a long time. And
there's a movie called Roger Rabbit.
Weird. Yeah. Super realistic. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was my thing, is like, why can't I have walked into a bar many a time to see Donald Duck and Daffy Duck having it out on dueling pianos? Like, yeah.
Which rock?
Go back to the realism of Betty Boop as a out of work cartoon character.
Yes. Yes. But just all that to say, you know, as again, we've talked Zemeckis to death, but just, it's not new. He's not jumping on some train being like, ooh, cool AI, I can steal people's fucking work. He's exploring the same shit he's been exploring since the early 90s, just with new tools and new ideas. And as far as people who just react negatively to the look of it, again, it's all on purpose. Zemeckis didn't see when his effects team, Image Movers, when they finished and sent him the rough cut or whatever, he didn't look at it and go, nope, it's supposed to look hyper realistic. This doesn't, that's not what I asked for. You did it wrong. You did the de-aging wrong. He went, excellent, that's exactly what I wanted, because this movie is about an unnatural existence and the unnatural existence of human beings and what we have done as we have not been a part of this world, in my opinion, because we were one of the only species that long ago quit being of any worth to the earth that we're on. We stopped serving our purpose a long time ago. That is in itself inherently an unnatural existence. And so in my opinion, That's why Zemeckis loves to do this and why he wants it to look that way. It's not meant to look like fucking hyper real.
Are you, but Will, humankind gave us the Lazy Boy chair.
Oh my God. Holy shit. I watched it twice, by the way, but when that segment started with, cause what's the word? What does he call it before?
Damn. Yeah. What does he, the relaxy boy.
Yeah. The relaxy boy. As soon as I heard that, I was like, Bobby, if you were anywhere near me, I'd just give you the biggest hug I could, man. This shit is so funny.
I mean, it's not for naught that, okay. So I agree with most of what Will is saying. The technological, that might be a subjective view of Will, but I'm willing to, you know what, for one of the first times I'm willing to take a bite. And I do think, however, though, that if just getting shortcomings of technological undersight out of the way, I get where people are coming from, but I think you're babies. But I also think like, it's tough with the voices. That's the one thing. That's the one thing that is a tough thing to make the jump over. And we saw Marty do it with The Irishman. I mean, it's tough to de-age a voice. And though I do think that, I mean, I only think we look at the unreality of these faces because we know it's not. Like, if you stare at something long enough, you're going to see the artifice of it. Like, yeah. We're not idiots. Some of us are, but most of us aren't like, whoa, that's bosom buddies Tom Hanks that just popped on. How'd they do that? Like, yeah. You know, like if you were someone who that you made your whole stink about like that, then life's got to be so boring and tedious for you, I'm sure. So
my last, like, I guess, support for the, at least, again, like you said, and I appreciate you taking a bite, entertaining the idea of it outside of the shortcomings. Zemeckis knows what that fucking deer looks like, and he knows what that goddamn hummingbird looks like, just like he knew what that feather looked like in Forrest Gump.
Well, that hummingbird and that feather are...
None of them look realistic, okay? And he knows that. He doesn't think you're going to see that hummingbird and go, holy shit, did they cut in real footage? No. That's not why it's there.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, unfortunately, we could have gotten away with, is that real or is that not, when the feather fell from the sky? But that was the 90s. We are in an era now where there's everything is green screen, technologically just diarrheaed all over a screen. Like, we're in an era that isn't, I mean, he probably helped foster, but like, he was going always in a different direction with how he saw technology. I mean, you know, like,
well, blaming him for that would be the same as like blaming Scorsese for what most gangster movies are. That's, you know, it's silly.
No, exactly. So, I mean, he's always been mostly in step with the technology, but maybe the world's become out of step with where he's at right now. So one thing we hate on this podcast is just when, because most podcasts make their whole show about this, is just describing stuff beat for beat and telling you how, you know, I just felt her in that scene and it made me think of feelings that I had. We're not going to do that. But the plot, just based, if you, you know, you might be wondering from the trailers what this is, you know, it is taking place in one single corner of a space in a house that becomes a house. I guess it's a corner of the world. It's not really about a house. It really is about a space and time and everything that it sees going throughout it. Now, you're probably assuming it just moves chronologically. It doesn't. It very astutely switches between time. The main focus of the movie, however, is Robin Wright Penn and Tom Hanks's characters, and then Tom Hanks's parents, played by Kelly Riley and Paul Bettany, who kind of, I mean, that's the main focus, right, of the movie, you would say, are those characters. And like,
yeah, Zemeckis is, if you will.
yeah the emphasis, the mirroring of the generations and what happened to the people in those relationships. But again, it also shows characters, like there's a character in the 20s who invents the Lazy Boy. There's a guy who invents an airplane that kills him.
Yep.
These are all technological feats. One is an airplane. One is a thing that helps you recline to probably watch the movie, you know, in the theater. You know, Zemeckis is aware of these seats recline now. And so there's like, you know, there's, it starts with this kind of like, this zone is pregnant with invention. Ben Franklin was there. One of the first human necklaces, I guess, is what he's trying to say, was, you know, crafting was done at this place. A guy invented, helped, you know, contribute to the invention of the airplane. We have the guy who invented then the Lazy Boy. It's a very interesting.
We also have people house flipping.
That's right. Of course, we have the house flippers as well. That's very,
as we've talked about, obviously to death with Forrest Gump and throughout his whole career, how Zemeckis converses with race in American history is not lost here on the Black family being a young up and coming couple moving in just to flip a house who also have a Latina maid. Who has, well, I won't spoil it, but let's just say I already got upset when I tried to find anyone talking about any of that. And of course, it's all just like, of course, that's what this man did, because this movie's, again, a celebration of boomers. But I think the reason I wanted to make sure we brought it up, when, especially when we're talking about invention, because I think that's his angle there with the house flipping, you know, when people stop being creative or live a life completely devoid of it, what they do with their energy and with their intelligence instead. But yeah, I don't know. Sorry, go ahead. Just wanted to make sure we brought that in, because I do think it's important. And I think, again, he's being so much smarter than everyone gives him, is giving him credit for with the casting there.
Yeah. Well, he's showing that human ingenuity and human invention is not a one-to-one thing. It's never about always like, it's not necessarily about propulsion of getting you through time with an invention. It's kind of about short term gains, you know, and that's like, it's the gain of this couple getting all this money for him inventing this Lazy Boy. You know, I mean, the parallels between probably what he might be saying about himself in his early career, because listen, we know him vaguely. We know his wife a little bit better. The scene where he's taking racy photos of his wife, the Lazy Boy guy, was not lost on me. But, you know, he's showing like, he is kind of showing like that, you know, when things are going well with one's work, it's generally a happier home environment. But then after all this kind of invention, before we get to the house flipping family, we have two generations that become more of the spotlight of this movie. So Kelly Riley and Paul Bettany come in. A man of his generation who drinks a little too much, very much a Robert Zemeckis auteurist touch.
Always.
And his sort of reliance on that and how he is worried. I mean, that's the main thing to me about this movie is like, there's the technological things, but then there's, and probably wrapped up with it is this, is the sense of worrying about the future and worrying about what's next and worrying and how that just, I mean, it's all, it's corny, but it's true. It stops a life, you know, it's kind of the opposite of living life. So much so that this kind of trauma male to male is passed down. From Paul Bettany to his son, played by Tom Hanks, who wants to be a draftsman. He wants to draw pictures. And in one of the most brilliant visual scenes of the movie, the pictures in the house mimic the blocks of rectangle that the screen puts in over the movie. Because that's the other thing in this movie is it is told through prisms, mini film screens, if you will, that show parts of the house. So you'll see a moment from the 20s coexisting with something from like the 50s, right?
All the way up, or you might see something begin before humans alongside the house flippers in present day.
Yeah. And so he's collapsing time and space within one single frame with frames within that frame. And yeah, you could just listen to all this and say, who gives a shit? You don't have to give a shit. But it's, if you care and you're interested in what a man's ideas about cinema are, this is a, I mean, he didn't dial this one in. Like, this is yeah. And I caution us to run too long just trying to like ruminate on it, because I do think that, like, one, I don't want to give things away, but also, like, I have a feeling this is a movie that we will return to over time and probably find new little pockets of, like, oh, he's doing that. Oh, you know? No, I mean,
I guess all I want to add, and then we can move on. Someone asked me about it, and I was like, I don't know. Time will tell, of course, thinking on it, but especially, and I won't spoil it, of course, but especially with the very ending, the final scene we have, and then the final note that we get, it is something that, at least as far as I know, definitely no other mainstream quote unquote filmmakers do, but something that to me, and I apologize for the jump, but you know, this is an experimental film in my opinion, but what Zemeckis does so beautifully is he's fascinated by experimental films, because the goal for them is to just, you know, in a lot of them, an onslaught of images and sounds, and see if you can create an emotional reaction out of that. And I think Zemeckis, his tool of experimentation outside of the visual here, is to see how far he can push you with sentimentality, with quote unquote corniness, but also still bring in such brilliant thought about our entire species over the entire time that we've existed, and whiplash you, especially in those final moments, and see if it works and see if it happens. And to me, I was floored, because I was, you know, same as you, I was weeping in the final moments. And then the grace note that he puts on there, that is such an angry, acidic little thing in my mind, kept me crying, but then got my brain going as well. You know, and I don't think any other mainstream filmmakers do things on this level. Because I really, we could talk forever, because I really do think this is one of the most brilliant takes on what it means to be a human. And it also does it without being finger wagging about, you know, how we live our lives and about economics and about just all of it. He just says, this is the reality that I see. You know,
no, I mean, it really commits to that God's eye view in that way. Yeah, okay, we'll move to the next one, but I will just say that what is new for this era, or this Zemeckis film, is Zemeckis has always been a man who has moved his camera to capture objects in space. Now his objects move within that space. I mean, the camera's fixed, it doesn't move, like, kind of, you know, it's closer to Griffith. I mean, String Me Up in town in the middle of Logan Square, but this is a little silent film technique-y of...
It's a combo of silent film and experimental film. I think this dude, I don't know. I think, like, the amount of filmmakers I thought of, especially the second time watching it, was crazy, because it was lots of silent stuff. But then also, and forgive me, but... like fucking Jordan Belson came to my mind. Like, I mean, that's someone who talks about the cosmos a lot. And I know it's potentially a silly jump, but like that was brought to my head because, you know, he put such limitations on himself to see what he could do. And Belson does the same thing. And also Belson is similarly a fiercely subjective filmmaker. And I think Zemeckis is as well. I think Zemeckis leaves more room for the audience to bring themselves. But anyway.
We could go. I mean, we are in a zone here of even classic cinema that is sentimental, that has another edge to it, and it makes me think of Make Way for Tomorrow by Leo McCarey. It makes me think really makes me think of Meet Me in St. Louis.
Absolutely.
And how it revolves around this one space for the most part over changing time. And it's kind of, you know, it moves not elliptically, but it moves with the passage of time, kind of feel, revolving around holidays of this family. And then also, you know, I mean, well, on that note, I mean, what are they going to go see in Meet Me in St. Louis? They're trying to go to the World's Fair exhibit. Some of those Our Town exhibits in there kind of do something very similar with different frames. So, interesting. See, sometimes we don't even know what we're thinking until we start talking about it.
We gotta stop. We're gonna get excited.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of iconic representation of history is like, yeah, no, it's a.
At the end of the day, just look. If you listen to us, hopefully you do this anyway. But as always, and especially with something like this, all we ask, just let yourself make up your own mind before you watch it. I mean, sorry, after you watch it, not before, not from the internet or from your friends. Just watch it and see what happens and then make up your own mind.
Yeah, yeah. And don't worry about people who've long since been fans of Zemeckis who might say that this wasn't for them. Just go your own way.
Oh, we don't trust them.
Well, there's one who's there's someone who's been on this show before who's
really
yes.
Wait, just say it and then we'll beep it because I'm curious.
It's really what I wonder if there's
wow.
Let's say I'm not surprised that
I'm just disappointed, but I guess I will say maybe that person you mentioned is doing a little bit of much. Of what Bettany's doing in the movie.
Might you be
hit too close to home?
Might hit a little too close to home.
What do we got coming up, my dude?
All right, yeah, we're at the midpoint. What do we have coming up? Boy, there's a lot. Let's see. Tuesday. We're gonna take this step by step here. Tuesday.
November. Celebrating the greatest.
Well, yeah. Oh, man, damn. I mean, I'm amazed that they even let me put this in there. This is very not a Terror Tuesday pick, but shout out to Jake Isgar. We love you. He let me put this in there. This is The Great Anne Hoy's Visible Secret. One of the best. I mean, we'll talk about Anne further, but...
We will, for sure.
She's never
little fun for those listening. We're going to go through the entirety of Milky Way Image, which if you don't know what that is, do a quick type right now. Get ready to pass out because we're going to talk about some of the most important and some of the least important films that have ever come out.
Yes, yes. And we should probably eventually talk. Right. Very true. we probably could also talk about Anne's career a little bit at some point. Just very briefly. I mean, she was one of the greats. She's along with Choi Hark, one of the original filmmakers. You know, like I'm gonna be honest, I don't think Wong Kar Wai would be Wong Kar Wai if it wasn't for her cinema. Because she started in 1979, her first film, The Secret, which I don't know if anyone here has seen that movie, but if you come to Visible Secret, you're going to want to watch The Secret.
We'll have it ready.
Yeah. Oh, it's... Oh, damn. I love The Secret. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think that movie's
perfect. I love it. I also, for any folks listening, and, you know, that we don't have a great copy of it out there, but I've done a lot of, for no reason, work on that one myself, so we'll happily share that with you.
I think there's a Blu-ray.
No. Well, there is, but it's bad.
Yeah, so it's missing some. Yeah,
I gave it some love.
Yeah, it's well, if you're a Patreon person, you know what to do. But yeah, this was people like to call it a giallo-esque. Yeah, shut the. We got to take 1 year of not using giallo for 1 year. That's the challenge. Yeah, I guess there's a murder mystery at stake, but it's closer to like Don't Look Now. I mean, it's really closer to like, it's the perfect early Hong Kong when Hong Kong was angry. And like,
yeah.
This is, you know, the formal flourishes were really new wavy, you know, elliptical and whatever, you know, it's just got such propulsion at this time.
It rules. What's up after that?
Did I say the date for that? Yeah. November 12th, Visible Secret, what was called Hong Kong's The Sixth Sense. Come check it out. Oh, and we got Shu Qi in it. Come on.
Sure.
On shout out our girl, she's played before and So Close. And maybe you've seen her in Millennium Mambo, which just weirdly came out a week after this, which is so funny. And they're very, there's a little similarity. But anyway, we got Visible Secret. You want to be there for Visible Secret. Don't be left behind. All right. November. All right. So
16th, next Saturday, because you'll probably get this done today. If not, whatever. Saturday the 16th, partnered up with our buds, at the Leather Film Archives and Museum. And they have kindly decided to let us show Tokyo Decadence. And you know what? I'll say in a good way, because it'll be fun and entertaining. John's going to have to rein me in on the introduction. This is the kind of stuff I care too much about. And I'm going to be talking too much about both Roman porno and Pinku films and how we got to where we are with Tokyo Decadence. It's going to be great. Come check out the Leather Archives. Still some tickets left.
We'll talk, but he might, how I get the cat to chill down, you know, I might do a little.
Well, it'll be the rare time though, because you're actually going to like what I'm saying. You're just going to correctly realize it's time to stop.
Yes. Well, you know what? We both love the shit out of that movie. Maybe we'll both be rambling. It's pretty exciting. So come out to the Leather Archive for a nice kinky time, because who knows? Maybe they'll have us back to do something else. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's right. Sorry, I forgot that. We had that plan for a year, and so I've completed
2 days after that.
Whew, there's a lot going on. Okay. 2 days after that, Monday, November 18th, at the, you might have heard of it if you live in Chicago, the Music Box Theater.
Yep, R-E-N-I-D-E-R.
In case you don't know what that is, just so you know, we are going to be showing one of the best. A movie, listen, if you're upset about how the election turned out, you might really vibe with this movie, because it gets you right now. And that is Alan Arkin's Little Murders.
Yep.
Starring Elliot Gould, and the late Donald Sutherland in one of the funniest roles ever.
Probably his greatest bit role ever.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, honestly, this side of Animal House, as people like to say, the greatest bit role Donald Sutherland ever had.
Yeah. I would agree. Yeah. Yeah. You don't get to see his ass in this one, but you know, he does deliver one of the best monologues.
And also in a way that truly only Donald Sutherland could have. The pace and delivery of that monologue only could have happened for him.
Absolutely. No, this is black as coal as satire and black comedy gets. This is the true substance. This is the real stuff here. So if you want,
and it's a 35 millimeter print.
Oh, I'm so excited. I am so excited to see this.
Who's gonna join you on a Q&A after?
Well, we're gonna be joined by our lovely friend Sam Deegan, the author, film historian. Listen, if you own Blu-rays from Vinegar, what?
No, you can just stop. If you own Blu-rays, she's
I was gonna say, if you own Blu-rays, she's on them. So,
yeah,
you've listened to her, you've seen her, you may have listened to her podcast, Eros and Massacre. Very interesting, given that her podcast talked about Rob Grillet, Anne Hoy wrote her thesis in college about him. Didn't know. Just interesting. Anyway, yes, she will be with us. She'll join me on stage for a little talk about Little Murders. Maybe we'll talk about Alan Arkin's still missing follow-up, Fire Sale. Terrible copy online, but boy, I'd love to see that movie get a Blu-ray treatment. If you own the Blu-ray of Little Murders, Sam is on that as well.
And also, before and after the film, Sam will be selling copies of her new book that she edited and also wrote for, Revolution 35mm, which obviously we give our big fat stamp. So come through, meet Sam, you won't regret it. And also just a random one, maybe my all-time favorite Sam commentary, if you've never heard it, on Abel Ferrara's Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy. One of her greatest, in my opinion.
I've not heard that one, but I am.
It's so good. It's honestly, maybe other than Devil's Honey, those were the first two that I was like, who the fuck is Sam Deegan? I got to know this person.
Yeah, and we're happy to call her a pal now, and we are very excited to have her join
us. What are we doing 2 days after that?
And 2 days after that, she's sticking around. That's how, you know, she knows what's up. She's sticking around. She's going to hang out with us to go across the city to the Davis Theater, where on Thursday, November 21st, we are going to finally get back into the swing of things with our hit blind screening series, Trust Fall. That is, if you don't know what that is, it's a mystery movie. You don't know what you're going to get. So you buy a ticket, you sit down. What could it be? But listen, we're not the Siskel. Okay. We're not putting a Lee Chang Dong movie in there or.
Hey, I mean, I'd love to show Oasis to a blind crowd. Watch yourself.
Oh, God. Of course. But we're not throwing in like an American in Paris. You had no idea. We don't do that. No. We
make it worth your while.
We make it way worth your while. And this one, oh boy. Let me just say, if you liked the idea of what I was talking about with Anne Hui's early career in Hong Kong, could this be in that vein?
Honestly, if you combine Visible Secret, Little Murders, you're still not as angry or as punk as the movie we're about to show. Not even close.
Or is brilliant. I mean, I love both of those. We're talking about
they're both masterpieces. Movies. But that's how Lux truly what we're going to give you guys is. And also the amount of work we put into this.
Is insane. If you're a film person, you're at this thing. You're not going to miss this. Because you miss this, it will never play again. Sure, maybe Charles Burnett might be there at night. But guess what? You're not going to get to meet him. You're going to hear him from a distance. He's old. He's probably not going to remember things. And also, do you need to see Killer of Sheep again?
And also, look, we love Charles Burnett. One of his other better than Killer of Sheep movies is actually in our new Trust Fall trailer.
Out
in the world soon. And so, you know what? Maybe a different Burnett and not the same one that plays every time will be at a Trust Fall Sunday. Maybe not. Who knows? But regardless, promise you this will not play because, and just for a hint, I'll give a hint. It's fine. Even MoMA in New York supposedly was playing the correct version of the movie that we're going to show. And they did not. They played the same one that has played. So this is technically the first time, maybe it played in Hong Kong. I don't know.
Not long. I mean, there's a big hit. Yes.
Oh, but I don't know if this cut even played in Hong Kong is what I'm saying. I don't know if that ever even played. So this
probably played at the midnight premiere when it came out.
This is at the very least the first time since it came out that this is going to play in a theater. And what we're saying to you is we are putting in the work more than MoMA is. So come through.
Yeah. Truly come through. You don't want to be at the Siskel on a Thursday. Come on. What are you, hang out with the bag ladies? They don't know what they're saying.
No, they're going to be at this show. I talked to them.
Yeah, we talked to them. No. You know where you want to go. No one wants to be in that fucking lame ass institution. Anyway, so now let's get to the second movie.
Yeah. No, I'm really excited to talk about the second movie. Now that we've finished talking about Robert Zemeckis's Here.
Yes. We are talking about Clint Eastwood's Juror Number 2 and Warner Brothers' hit job on the movie that has not worked out for them.
I found out a little today. Can I dig in a little real quick?
Yeah. To
how it happened? I didn't know this till today. So apparently when they first talked to Clint, this gets greenlit. Warner Brothers said to him, "This is streaming only," he said. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, "If that's the only way to get it made, fine." And so it was HBO Max who they signed up with. And then what they had talked about is potential for a brief theatrical release at some point. And Clem was like, "Okay, I just want to make the movie, you know, as always." He's like, "Cool, let me start so I can finish shooting it immediately." Then, you know, a couple months ago, whatever, Warner Brothers hit him up and was like, "Okay, we can do a couple, I guess." And Clint's like, "Okay, great." And that was because they got the invitation to be the closing night film of the AFI Fest this year. And that couldn't have gone better. As far as reaction from audience and critics alike, people were very excited. So Warner Brothers stayed committed to it, but gave it the paltry 31 theaters or whatever.
Which turned out to be 22.
Yeah. And that has since changed because, and this is all I really wanted to bring up before we get into the meat, because it's a good part of the Clint story. I don't think we've covered it before. The reason that changed is because in France, this made over 3 million very quickly. And Warner Brothers noticed that, of course, and was like, oh, shit. But the quick thing I just want to say.
Wait, the French love Eastwood?
Yes, but we've never talked about why they do them. And I didn't realize that. Mm. There's a dude named, filmmaker named Pierre Ressillon. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say it because it's French. You know, good filmmaker in his own right, but mostly known for being a champion of movies just at large and helping a lot of filmmakers along the way. Yeah. We're talking people like fucking Lino Braca. That's why you know who he is. Mike Lee, even though they fought a lot and eventually stopped.
Oh, he was together. This guy was Clint's biggest cheerleader. He was like,
he saw Pale Rider in 85 at Cannes, lost his mind and was like, this is, we have to do this. And so he, from then on, was an enormous champion and helped get a lot of his fellow Frenchmen on board with him. And it's worked. And look, what we got a text today from our good buddy Rebecca, who is in France attending the Clint Eastwood Film Festival at a movie theater.
Yeah, I mean, they've always gotten it, just how they've always kind of gotten American genre filmmakers. And, you know, Clint, and we've said many times, is a part of that world, even though he's, you know, kind of moved out, like Manuel de Oliveira. Like his world extends to the past, but he is still alive. Well, Manuel is not alive anymore, but he was for quite a while. And Clint is alive as of now, thank God. Let's hope it stays that way. And we get one more, even though this would be a perfect closing movie. And we'll get spoilery, but I'll give you my take on that. But
we're going to get spoilery with this one, by the way. We tried to avoid with here, but we're going to talk on this one.
Yeah, but so with Clint, you know, Pierre Ressillon was a big part of it. Serge Denis also was a huge champion and helped kind of like close that circle. And yeah, Pale Rider did well. I mean, it was one of the only places that gave props to Bronco Billy, and I'm not even a big Bronco Billy fan. That's like one of my least favorite.
Yeah, it's one of the worst, but I bless him for being like, sorry, this is better than most stuff coming out here.
Yeah. I think they compared it to Nicolas Ray's The Lusty Men.
Yeah, which is pretty. It's
only like, in France.
Quite a leap, I will say, but I appreciate it.
Bronco Billy wishes it was anywhere close to The Lusty Men. But
that sounds like when I compare some of my like backyard movies to, you know, whoever. Pick your tour. It really does sound like that. Sometimes I belong in France.
Yeah, maybe you're some Frenchman and we just haven't known this whole time.
Oh yeah, no one's ever thought of that.
But yeah, no, I mean, so yes, Clint has always had a big foothold over there, and even Japan too. I mean, I'm forgetting his name right now, but the teacher that educated a lot of the 80s, 90s era of emerging Japanese filmmakers like
Hiroshi. Oh, yeah, I can't remember. We talked about him at one point.
Yeah. It's a Japanese name that is escaping me right now. But he was also a big fan and talked to his students a lot about Clint Eastwood. So, you know, the art of Clint has always kind of blossomed in various places. Mr. Dave Kerr, who's been on the show, has been a long champion, who's always, you know, for, you know, the most part, you know, understood his cinema. So what took it so long to get to this place? Now, with Warner Brothers, we mentioned before all that, and we said this on a bonus episode, so the public didn't hear this, but, you know, you're aware that Mr. Zaslav, there was at Warner Brothers, there was the leaked phone call or the leaked board meeting where he said, we don't owe anybody favors, especially Clint Eastwood or something like that. Even though he made Warner Brothers what it is, he brought it accolade.
$4 billion.
$4
billion. That's a round down. $4 billion since he brought Mount Paso to them.
Exactly. I mean, they had to give him his own space on the lot to feed squirrels because like, that's like he earned it. Like he made the modern Warner Brothers now so that they could do their fucking Dark Knight shit, which I guess you can now go see again at the Music Box. How cool. But fuck.
Stay on course. Stay on course.
Stay on course. Sometimes I'm a little mad. But yeah, you know, like this is, you know, he is the modern Warner Brothers. Anyway, they didn't want to do that. So this became what seemed to be a very personal battle between Mr. Zaslav and Eastwood. And there was a rumor, which I don't buy, going around that it was because of his politics, Eastwood's perceived politics, that it got treated this way. When it's like, well, look who just won the presidency. I don't know if that was a small fringe. I don't think we can pretend that anymore. I think the world voted this twat in. And
also, let's not pretend that Zaslav, first of all, has politics. Zaslav is an Epstein.
Well, he just came out the other day saying that he's so glad Trump became president because it's going to be good for business. So I don't buy that. And also, you know, Eastwood's never been like a Trump supporter. He had a thing come out once where he said people are getting too upset over Trump and to quit being a pussy. And you know what? He's right. He's right. We lived through this shit before. We'll live through, well, maybe not some immigrants and Palestinians, but we will make it through this again. You know, and so like the Clint Eastwood politics have always been the stupid game of like, let's push it back and forth of like, is it okay to like him? Is it okay to not like him? He's a mystery when it comes to his politics, but he's also not a right winger. And I think his movies.
Definitely not. That's what we know for sure.
We know that for sure.
And we've talked about it to death. At worst, he's an annoying libertarian. It's not a fucking high winger, though.
But a lot of your favorite filmmakers who you rave about on your Letterboxd are probably right wingers. So it doesn't matter. So where are we at with this? So it's clearly not the politics. So, you know, what was the reason for this? I mean, the movie was not going to be over budget. Clint is famously never over budget. This guy gets his shit in on time. He's the consummate director. But for whatever reason, this was the rollout, and I don't quite understand it. You know, it's like, it has to be personal because Warner Bros. Is in the business of making money. This movie didn't. Also,
as soon as they saw this, I wonder if Zaslav has even watched it.
Probably because not.
I mean, I said it to you the other day, but I have never seen more of a home run guaranteed to be shocking how much money it will make movie. I can't even, I mean, since you and I have been fucking adults, man, like this is such a home run.
Absolutely.
Everybody, because it truly is, he successfully makes it politic-less, where there's truly a cast of characters all sharing their opinions. The movie's only strong opinion is that our criminal system does not work well.
Yes. Yeah, this is not
like, why. It doesn't say because of left or right. It just says it's not great. How do we all fix that?
This isn't a gamble like Cry Macho.
No, yeah, because Cry Macho.
You can like Cry Macho, but it's a, you know,
it's a gamble.
That's for the Clint heads, you know. Yes. That's for the people who've watched Anyway But Loose, Every Which Way But Loose, and Any Which Way You Can. And that's who that one's for. It's a special little treat for us all. Maybe not for mainstream consumption, you know, but even movies, I mean, he's always had little outliers. I mean, there's 1517, there's Hereafter, movies that, you know, didn't do what people wanted for him, or Jersey Boys, but you know, he's an otter filmmaker, but you're right. This is a no-brainer. This is a slam dunk. It hits every fucking beat. Like,
who would slay in every market?
My mom saw it yesterday. Yeah, she's like,
I was gonna say, it's for moms, and it's also for people who are as mentally ill about movies as you and I are. Yeah. And that's an impossible thing to do normally.
I mean, if you look at it this way, he's squaring himself with the history of American film genres. He's given us Westerns. He's given us gangster to a certain degree. He's given us a musical. And now he's given us the courtroom drama.
Yep, which he...
I'll be happy.
Yeah, and the last time... Wait, is that true? Yeah, he also shot in Savannah. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Last time he was shooting in Savannah. And that's the
Richard Jewell,
something like this. Richard Jewell. Yeah.
But never
to this level.
Yeah, I mean, this is Richard Jewell is definitely more about like how the media and how the powers that be can not do their job and craft a narrative to help, you know, fit it. This is the same story almost, but on a smaller scale, very firmly within the courts of Atlanta, which is very controversial these days.
And also, this is not to not be discussed. Richard Jewell, especially, is a movie about someone who didn't do something wrong.
Yeah.
This movie fits into, you know, I guess, do you like Gran Torino or Mule or whatever kind of things? Those movies are about people who are eventually forgiven, right, for their wrongdoings. This is about someone who did do something wrong through whatever circumstances that came, but does not necessarily get that forgiveness.
No, this is a pretty...
it's really interesting.
In it, movie, in a way. It's a very, like...
And where it reminds me, you know, I have to bring it up. I'll bring up the most obvious one first, but of course he's in a Hitchcock mood, I think, but just writing the script, not necessarily making the movie. But of course there's The Wrong Man, because, you know, this is that classic kind of story, wrong man, wrong place, wrong time, except this isn't the wrong man, it's the right man. So that puts us more in Hitchcock territory, something like I Confess, which is about someone being unable to do the right thing because of systems that are in place.
I would agree. I would say it's even closer to Fritz Lang's Beyond a Reasonable Doubt.
Absolutely. Yep.
I mean, very, that's almost a one-to-one. And I only thought of that till you just brought that up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, it's more that the visual style is I Confess. The story structure, I think, is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt.
Really? Because I almost think it's the opposite. I think it's that, you know how we talk about the late Eastwood style as kind of being, people find it to be boring, right? Sure. You know, like it's very elemental. It gets to it. He's not doing a lot of his, he's not working with the same cinematographers, but he's also not worried about the same camera setups. It's very to the point, basic. And I think that's how Fritz Lang became, at the end of his career, before he went to Germany and made like The Indian Tomb and Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse. Like those early American films, I think I have them right behind me. Yeah, like Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, While the City Sleeps, they kind of have a more pared down elemental sort of film style. You know, like he still shoots a corner very menacingly in a room, but it's like it doesn't have the flourishes of, say, you know, German expressionism.
That's why I think I Confess, though, too, because part of why people didn't like it is because it was more pared down for Hitch at the time. But and it's more specifics, not the whole thing. I should say there's quite a few visual moments that bring to mind I Confess, where he, you know, on the steps of the courthouse, shoots behind our Lady of Justice with the characters below it, similarly to, you know, Jesus menacing over Montgomery Clift and I Confess. That's what I mean more. Like
I would bet he had I Confess and Beyond a Reasonable Doubt both in his mind.
Absolutely.
While this movie was being made. So just brief, the plot. Yeah, a guy is on a jury. He's about to have a kid with his wife. He gets sent to jury duty. Over the course of the trial, he thinks, as the court releases the evidence, what they have, that he may know what happened in the trial or in this incident of a woman who died. The court wants, the state wants to wrap this up very nicely, a la Richard Jewell. And they have their wit. They have their suspect because he fits the profile, you know, and he seems like a guy who would kill his girlfriend. But then eventually Nicholas Holt, the main guy on the jury, realizes maybe I think I might be the one responsible for this person's death. And it's, you know, obviously, like, as much as we're talking about realism, like something like this would probably never happen. But that's so not the point of this. This is a masterclass in not only Clint Eastwood's cinema, but walking you through specific suspenseful beats and doing it with the grace of an old master who says, I'll just take a little stroll here, and I'm gonna, like, he does it without aplomb, you know what I mean? Like, he's
which is so much harder, in my opinion. And in an age where we're suffocating under quote unquote style at every turn, I think it's so much harder to actually just tell a good fucking story in basically 90 minutes. And I think this movie exists to just jump off what you said. It's not, I don't think it's meant to be strict reality, just like the filmmakers we've already talked about. Where they thrive is within the anxieties that exist within our reality. And anxiety itself is something that perverts reality as soon as it occurs to us, right? Like, that's what makes us make the dumb decisions we do, because of anxiety and because of stress. And this is a movie that exists in that mindset, because right on the one side, the guy who's the perfect suspect, something that Clint loves to explore is people who have actually changed, but it doesn't matter. And so you have this supposed perfect suspect who's just begging and quivering with all his might for someone to believe him that he did actually put in the work to change. Doesn't mean he's perfect. Doesn't mean he doesn't still yell at her, still breaks beer bottles, still does bad shit, but he left the life behind that everyone assumes he still is. So you have that. And then you have this guy who's supposedly, you know, this perfect stand-up thing, but same thing. He also had a terrible moment with his drinking years before. And so he did quit, but he can't ever talk about if this did or didn't happen, if he did or did not kill this woman, because no one will believe him because he went to a bar, even though he didn't take a drink again. And Clint loves swimming in that territory of people who have actually put in the work, but it doesn't matter. Because you can put in the work for yourself and maybe convince people close to you, but society at large does not believe that people can change.
Yeah. And I think, like, more even drilling down on that is Eastwood's, he, throughout the beginning of his own movies, I mean, his movies have been a play between, am I a good person or am I a bad person? His characters, I can't stress this enough. Maybe there's a couple outliers. I'm not, like, I don't have a Clint chart right now, but from memory, they are all basically, am I guilty of something? What am I carrying inside me? I mean, think of just Bridges of Madison County. Yep. I mean, his character and Meryl Streep's character, they vacillate the whole movie between, like, is this the right thing? What is the right thing? Like, you know.
Tightrope as well. There's, I mean, we could.
Well, sure. I mean, have it. I mean, even the Francesca character of Meryl Streep and Bridges, I mean, like, that is very, in a way, kind of pretty similar to the Nicholas Holt character, because it's like, do I abandon family, you know, to do what I know is the right thing or what I want? Like, they're different. I mean, maybe, you know, Nicholas Holt knows that he has to say something, but his wife's pregnant with their kid, you know, he would leave that father, or he'd leave that child fatherless. So it's a similar dilemma, except, I mean, obviously Francesca didn't kill anybody except get her pussy straight up murdered by.
Well, but that's also a question that Clint loves, is when society decides to measure ills.
Yeah.
You know, and I promise I'm not here to say that there's any question if it's worse to, like, fucking kill someone or step out on your sad marriage. But Clint likes to swim in those waters.
Yeah. And I think, like, what is so interesting, and we won't, you know what, maybe because there might be some people who still haven't seen this.
We shouldn't do everything, because also we'll do this for 13 hours.
We're going to zip.
Can I shout out one character before we stop?
You can shout out multiple characters, because one of the most vexing things about this movie is, how are no one at least getting a supporting character actor? Yes. Not?
Okay, I mean, let's end on that. Yeah, let's talk about.
Well, we're gonna talk the ending, but
okay. Before we talk the ending, let's talk about also why this is a masterful, because this could have been just a pretty good courtroom drama, right? With a good center, with Nicholas Holt. And even with one good supporting, right, whether that's Toni Collette or it's J.K. Simmons, that would have been enough for this to be a good movie and an interesting movie. But in my opinion, nobody
is wasting. Wait, real quick. We have a fresh off the screening. We have a hot take. Rosemary, guest star Rosemary. Did you like it? Loved it.
I saw Will on the street. He knows how to
do it. Yeah, and there we go. Yeah.
Okay, and I'm leaving.
Okay, bye. See, there you go. Hot, yep. Right off the press. Someone who just Will and Will's wife and my lovely partner just saw the movie today. So that you heard it right there.
Because you have to in Chicago to see it right now. They journeyed.
Yeah, they go to Route 21, like it's a Hong Kong or Bollywood movie. Yeah. You had to go down there. Sorry,
but anyway, so
I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh no, you're good. So yeah, that could be a good movie, but why Clan so smart? And I think why people are bringing up 12 Angry Men so much, outside of the obvious things, right? And he makes an allusion to it as well with the glasses and the character who Tanner cannot see. He's not dumb. But I think the reason, whether they are conscious about it, people are bringing it up, is because 12 Angry Men is the ultra rare movie where there are 12 actual characters in that. And that's why we talk about it so much forever. This movie pulls that off almost entirely, in my opinion. And one of the strongest ones, the moment I knew, like I knew we were in good hands because it's fucking Clint, but the moment I knew this was going to be really special, what's his fucking name? Cedric Yarbrough. Who most of us grew up watching on fucking Reno 911, right? His character in this film is so fully formed. And again, similar to what we were talking about with Zemeckis, it's not an accident where Clint brings up these things and has these conversations about what it would be like to be the one Black person in this room. And the way that they do it is basically the first time we meet Cedric's character, they're the what, sorry?
There's two.
Well, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean. I know there's... Well, that's one of the things we're going to talk about that's not great, because there are two people who are not characters. That's one of them to me.
Yeah, I mean, what? You say the Black woman and the stoner?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know. You need them in there. We got to represent...
Well, they're funny. They're good. They're good for levity, I will say. They both provide levity, and they're not bad. Like, it doesn't ruin anything at all. But anyway, so Cedric, why it hits so hard, I think, is because the first time when we see the attorneys interviewing the potential jurors before everyone's chosen, the first thing that Cedric gets asked, because he's a large Black man, is if he's ever beat one of his partners. And understandably, he's like, Jesus Christ, did you ask everyone that? You know, and so we start there. And as the film progresses, we see him wrestling with a world where, you know, I won't spoil what, but whether it's family he's lost or friends he's lost or whatever, living in a world where no matter how much work these people put in, no one's going to believe they've changed perceptions of Black people in America, while he struggles with this whole room of people. And why he's so resistant to Nicholas Holt's character being like, no, 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 this guy changed for sure. This white dude changed, who was also in a gang, but he definitely changed. Don't worry about it. While we know that Nicholas Holt's character is literally guilty. It's just incredible. Like, that's such a big chunk of this movie for me, and why it rings, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
That shouldn't be well written, but they pulled it off.
They pulled it off. And like you said, this could have been just your standard courtroom drama. I mean, there's a reason people do it. One, they're cheap, one location, and you know, they're built on suspense. So if you have some minute understanding of the building blocks of movies, you could probably pull it off. I mean, we last year watched Friedkin's Last.
Yes, which I, even though I liked more than you, this one just highlights what's missing from that one, which is a supporting cast.
Yeah, and a certain ingenuity that I think maybe turned off at that point in his life.
Yeah, you know.
And I liked the Kane Mutiny court martial quite a lot. Well, not a lot. I liked it, but I'm just saying this is like...
Well, that's a good movie. This is a great movie.
Yeah. This is what very he does. Difference. I'm just saying, like, if you really want to see, like, elevation of this genre, just watch those two back to back and you'll see, like, you know, what makes Juror Number Two so special. They also
share you'll learn about
Peter Sutherland, who they know how to show a man whose brain and face has been ravaged by alcohol. Truly bravo casting. The lighting on Kiefer in this movie was like, Clint sees you. Maybe everyone else tries to paper it over and say, look, he'd still be the 24 guy, but No, not Eastwood. Eastwood sees things for how they are.
Well, he also likes Signs of Life on a Face. That's one of his favorite things, including his own.
Yes.
You know, speaking of bridges, you know, like he likes to see life on people.
No, he understood when Ford, you know, they accused him being a master of the tableau, but then he said, but the greatest thing is that I, you know, is the human face. And he spoke of the close-up as basically being abused, something I've carried with my whole life, because the close-up is one of the easiest shots to do, but it's also the hardest to imbue with meaning. And, you know, that's why great directors can make a close-up just like you see the power of it. Silent cinema certainly understood that better than anyone, but Eastwood still has those powers in him. And yep. Faces.
I'm glad you mentioned it too, because Ford we hadn't mentioned yet, and I do think that's an important other filmmaker alongside the two we did talk on with this movie.
Yeah. No stranger to the courtroom, Sergeant Rutledge. But I think what's so interesting though with is this is a movie about faces. It's truly a movie about eyes and about perception. It's so cinematic, but it really is. The movie is just people looking at each other, wondering. That's every scene of the movie is like, every single scene. I think I see, or how much am I putting myself into the image that I'm, you know, viewing with my eyes? And yeah.
I just want to add to what you're saying, because I think part of what Clint understands too, and the one moment that actually made me cry in this movie, is because Clint understands not only that looking and that perception, what you're talking about, but how crucial and embarrassingly core that is to us feeling like we exist as human beings. Yeah. Because when they go to interview the guy who supposedly is the eyewitness, which is the, you know, especially the callback to the 12 Angry Men, woman in bed with glasses moment. This man clearly lives alone in his trailer. His partner is long gone. His family's long gone. And for once, people wanted to talk to him. And he's so excited to have anyone care what he thinks. But the final moment we spend with him is him questioning if he did actually see what he thought he saw. But that's not what's important. What's important is the look on his face and that his heart is broken, that he knows yet again he's now alone, because turns out his perspective didn't matter, because it wasn't what people wanted.
Yeah. But yeah. And they're not going to come to question it. Yeah.
So that scene.
No, he'll constantly have to look out and see people gathering around this space, questioning, calling into question everything he said. And I think what really is so cool about that ending, so if you don't want to hear this, keep jumping ahead, but I hope you've seen it by this point, because you're part of the problem, or not, because you need to keep bumping these numbers up. Bump the numbers up for Clint. If any of you steal this movie, you're going straight to the gulag. Put that money to give it to Clint. But because there's more at stake here than just the Clint movie being good. Let's just keep in mind why we pay to go see certain movies now, but we don't need to say any more on that. But that ending. So the ending, he's with his newborn baby and he's sitting at home, and then the doorbell rings and it's the Toni Collette character, who we've spent this whole movie with her trying to figure out, did he do it? Does she want to know if he did it? Like, she's, you know, kind of, she's about to ascend to the, I mean, there's that great line, like, you're a politician now. The thing Eastwood hates.
Yeah, she's a DA. Very important in this movie. And towards Clint's politics, that she's decided she wants to do the right thing. She just finally got that big money spot.
Yes, she's very close to being a careerist like Olivia Wilde's character, and the trouble she causes. Toni Collette's character is a little smarter. Not as waspy. Definitely, I what I like so much about it is not like I thought. I mean, there were people who were like, they made Olivia Wilde just a classic bitch, and it's like, well, that was a real person, and I'm sure that person was a bitch like most journalists. But what's interesting here is he doesn't bother with it. Like, Toni Collette's character is so good in this movie that you never really know where she's gonna come down on. It's so set up for her to be the careerist, but there's more happening underneath the hood. So when she gets to that door and they look at each other, it cuts. Now, many people remember a movie called Sideways when Alexander Payne did that there, or any movie that has an ambiguous ending. So many never earn it. So many never.
I would say almost none earn it.
Yes, with a little spinning top, Mr. Christopher Nolan.
Oh, well, let's not sully. Let's be, no pun intended.
We're not sullying, because what I'm saying is here, I have never been so wrecked by an ambiguous ending. That was perfect, because leading up to it, the two eyes looking at Nicholas are the prosecutor's eyes and the eyes of an innocent child who has had no imprint of the world yet. He is perfect in his child's eyes. He has no blood on his hands. But not the when the prosecutor comes knocking, not in his own mind, not even in his wife's eyes, which vacillate between the child's and the prosecutor's. So by the time we've had this exchange of looks, a movie we've said is about looks being exchanged. We get the final exchange between the infant and the prosecutor. Just a beautiful representation to lead us to that ambiguous ending that says maybe he got away with it. Maybe he did. Probably didn't. If we look at the echoing of this final scene as opposed to like American Sniper's final scene, which also takes place in a doorway. If you're looking at it that way, it probably didn't end up very well. But I don't think Eastwood wants us to sit there going, did it or didn't happen, in the sense that most of the time we do that. I don't think he wants us to think he got away with it or didn't. I mean, the log line for all of Eastwood's cinema, I'm bringing it back to what I just said, is a character guilty or innocent? If Eastwood were to come down on potentially his final film with an answer, I don't know what that would say about the filmography that he's built up. He's well aware of what he's built towards in the movie he's made, that ambiguity is the whole nature of why his movies, at least for us, maybe especially me, I found him so fascinating, is that there's always this through line through his work, and he just literalizes it at the end. Like, the question remains, because it's the question of all of his cinema. Some come down on if it is or isn't, but most of the time they walk that ambiguous thread as well. So they don't give you that ending that you want sometimes. And this was the most like truly graphic representation of that. And I thought, if that's the coda to the end of his career, that's pretty good.
And he also did a perfect classic, in my opinion, Eastwood bait and switch, where he employs a classic Hollywood trope. So when they're in the cemetery and the dude working there, the caretaker, whatever, walks by him, and I forget exactly what he says, but he says, looks like the storm has passed. He says, yep, hope so. Or I can't remember if he says hope so or think so, but regardless, yeah. It's a very classic Hollywood moment to have a non-character just walk in to say something that they don't realize has weight, that for all of us has enormous weight, but then to pull that fucking rug out in the immediate following scene.
Yeah, it's great. So if we haven't convinced you, I would get someone to check your pulse right now. You might be flatlining. I would run, literally run to your theater.
Well, you have to also. It's going to be gone very soon. If it's not already in your town, it'll be
gone. We are so lucky that it got extended. Everyone is. It's like it. Warner Brothers is paying attention to a lot of people's stink about this. I mean, they're looking at the numbers also. But
they're not paying attention to stink. They're paying attention to money. That's it.
Well, I do think that maybe they're not paying attention to the stink, but the stink is helping drive those numbers up. So if you're online talking about talking about it. I do know a couple people who said, based off of things we said, they're going to go check it out now. So we're all doing our part to kind of help make this. And if you need any further, if you need one little nugget, if you're still not convinced, let me put it this way. When I sat down and watched this movie and it happened, and where we're at in the world now put me here, we have nothing really resembling the movies we grew up with. When I was watching this movie, I was thinking of, wow, there was a time when a mid-budget movie was just released in theaters. And there was also a time when great actors pretended to be Southern lawyers. And damn, do I miss that. I mean, Toni Collette in this movie, in the best sense, not in a crappy nostalgic way, transported me to a time when we did get like real movies.
It did me as well, but also, in my opinion, it improved upon that in a crucial way. Because even though I love every one of those, and some of them are great, yes, don't get me wrong, but when I walked out of it, I was like, I'm going to rewatch all of those, which I am. That's going to happen, and I'm going to love every single one of them. But what I'm going to notice, same as last time I did that, when I was missing movies like this, is that almost all those movies were heavy on the moralizing. Right? So you think about something, it doesn't matter. We don't need to name drop things, but most of those movies at the time were heavy on moralizing. This is a movie that says, I also miss when those things happened, but also we could do better than when it was a mainstay.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. We can ask more. We can still keep pushing this further, you know? Yep. Like, it doesn't have to end with, you know. You said something earlier, I can't remember about which movie, but style is kind of becoming one of our great enemies. And I don't mean style as it is. I mean style for style's sake. It's really becoming a beast.
It's a crutch. It's an embarrassing crutch. Where it's not people style. Who don't actually understand. No, it's imitation of style. It's
imitation. Correct. You're right. Yeah.
Well, it's like we talked about with Ty West. He understands what looks good and what looks interesting, but he doesn't understand the beating heart behind any of that. And so then what you get is empty version of that. And it feels weird and it doesn't feel good and it doesn't do anything. And that's where we're at. We're just a fucking onslaught of filmmakers who, yes, they can say this movie looks fucking cool. And they're right. That movie does look fucking cool. But then they just recreate it based upon that surface understanding and never look into understanding what made it actually create some sense of feeling or some sense of atmosphere or some sense of story. They stop when they go, looks cool, let's do it.
Instead, it leaves you cold. And I think people are starting to wake up a little bit. I mean, I have seen a lot more people who I would assume would have loved The Substance being like, no, that sucked.
Well, it's actually very split, which has given me hope as well.
Yeah. Not for the ones on the other side. You all are lost to time. There's no helping you. But if you're on that fence and you're like, I'm seeing these quote unquote pretty interesting images from social media, and I want to check this out because I like Cronenberg. I haven't seen them all, but I like Cronenberg. I like body horror, whatever. I like Demi Moore. You know, I want to see Margot Qualley naked. Whatever your reasons, it's fine. But like, I'm noticing more people getting to it and then wondering why they feel so cold at the end of the day. And your intuitions are probably correct. And you should definitely always follow them because like something is missing and it's hard to imagine if it's going to come back in the way that it used to be there. I mean, genius was never mainstream. Genius has always been where it's been, but it's getting further and further in the fringes. So we should be very happy that we have these two movies. One that you really got to give it a chance here. Just give it a shot. Like, you know, put out whatever your favorite people you follow online say. Just go into it. But I think
we got to shout out our buddy Louise Ward. Louise Ward's on our side. I believe all she said thus far is perfect.
Yeah, I don't know. She's been one of the few that came to the likes in something I put on Twitter. And Mr. Will Sloan, thank you, Mr. Will Sloan, and Dave Kerr. So I'm just saying, there are people who are backing it who know what you usually listen to them. So if you don't want to listen to us, they like this shit. So,
and again, even more importantly, first, just go fucking watch it for yourself.
Yeah.
And then decide. That's all we're ranting about everything, always, at the end of the day. Make your own decision.
Do you? All right. Well, until next time. Goodbye.
All right. We'll see you next time.